Why is Heritage Radio Network important to you?
HRN is very nostalgic to go into because it's really the only place that you have this really warm, homey experience to watch people get together and talk about the things that really make a difference.
It's really fun when I ask guests, do you want to be on Heritage? And they're like, at Roberta's? Yes, 100%.
I believe that we all are really trying to bring people together.
I think getting more people excited about good, local, well-crafted food and away from big ag and tasteless commodity food is so important.
It's kind of an honor to be sitting there with so many, in a space where so many other people have sat.
Join HRN's vibrant community of thoughtful eaters. Become a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Did you know that oat milk uses a lot less water, less land, and creates far less greenhouse gases than cow's milk? This useful fact is brought to you by Oatly, the vegan oat milk originally from Sweden that's now available in the U.S. You can find out more useful facts than you'd ever want to know about oat milk at oatly.com. That's OATLY.com. I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Marco Canora and Andrew Garner. Marco is the founder and Andrew is the CEO of Brodo, the fresh bone broth that jump-started the broth trend in 2014. That winter, Marco opened a little window next to his award-winning restaurant Hearth in the East Village. Pretty much immediately, people started lining up for coffee cups filled with Marco's delicious broth. Now there are 6 Brodo locations in NYC and a frozen product that they sell both online and in about 100 stores. I'm a huge fan of both of these guys and their broth, and I'm super happy to have you both here today. Welcome.
Thank you, Allison.
Thank you so much.
Marco, we're going to start with you.
Okay.
So you're a James Beard Award-winning best chef, a James Beard nominated cookbook writer. You were a judge on Top Chef. Mm-hmm. That's pretty rad. I'm assuming from your resume that you were always a food guy.
I was.
Yeah.
I was very lucky as a kid growing up in the 70s and 80s to live in a home in upstate New York where, you know, my mom cooked dinner every day. Mm-hmm. We had a garden. Mm-hmm. As a kid, I would, like, pick zucchini flowers and, you know, mom would make a frittata with the zucchini and zucchini flowers out of the garden.
Right, which is kind of unusual for 70s and 80s. I feel like people were living out of boxes and cans by then.
Yeah. I mean, she basically said she grew a garden because she couldn't find good vegetables at the local Grand Union.
Where was she born?
In Lucca.
Okay.
In Tuscany.
And so, and your father also born in Italy?
No, my dad was third generation, so he wasn't born and raised in Italy.
Got it. Okay.
But his lineage is in Calabria.
Right. Got it. And when you were little, were you quiet?
No.
I'm not picturing that at
I
all.
Wasn't. I wasn't a quiet kid. I wasn't a great student.
Yeah.
I fell in love with food very early on, and not just, you know, I didn't only enjoy eating food, and my mom was a great cook, but I really, I was really drawn to the beauty of food.
Yeah.
Like, as a very young kid, I really was always in awe of, like, how beautiful food was. And still to this day, I cook at home so much, and, like, I really am in awe of the beauty of food, the colors, shapes, the diversity, the fact that it, like, pleases people.
Yeah.
I mean, I am such a lover of food, and it's been in my bones since I can remember.
I got a mushroom like at the farmer's market the other day, and it was like a foot wide and like a foot tall, and it was just this most beautiful. And then, you know, on the back of the mushroom, those lines, it's like
the gills.
It's science and art, and I mean, tears rolling down my eyes.
Totally.
So I know how you feel. But you said you were a little bit late professionally into the cooking field, or
what
were you doing? What did you think you wanted to be?
The key word there is professionally. So my first job in high school was at a restaurant, and I was a dishwasher, and I loved it. I was like the best dishwasher ever, and I absolutely enjoyed it, and I loved that restaurant.
Yep.
And through college and through high school, I always worked in restaurants, but I didn't really take it seriously as this is going to be my career until I landed a job at Gramercy Tavern in the late 90s. Up until then, it was just a means to, I was good at it and I liked it, but it was never thought of as like, you know, I didn't go in stage in France at 16. Right. Like I really started in earnest in my late 20s.
Did you think you wanted to do something else? Like was there, or were you just kind of like having fun? Did you think you wanted another career?
Well, as a kid, I thought I wanted to be an architect.
Okay.
Because I was like so fascinated with the drawing board and pencils.
Yes.
And the way architecture used to be before it got, digitized. Mm-hmm. Drafting. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, that's the coolest thing ever. Yeah. And the lines and the precision and I really, you know, I'm kind of anal that way. Yep. I like precision and perfection.
I think there's a definite Venn diagram where a chef and an architect have overlap.
So. Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. And then, you know, I worked in the music business a little bit just to see what it was like.
Okay.
And I sat at a desk in Midtown across from like the late show theater, the Ed Sullivan Theater. And I did that for about a year and a half.
Not for you.
Absolutely not for me.
Right.
Sausage sandwiches and cans of Coca-Cola for lunch every day did not resonate with me. And sitting in an office and just taking phone calls and people screaming was just not my jam.
So was Tom Colicchio the chef at the time? Or who
at
was
Gramercy
at
Tavern?
Gramercy?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And so how did you get in the door there?
I basically just moved back to New York City with my girlfriend at the time who got accepted to NYU grad school for film. And I literally put on a suit and put a list together of places and hit the streets. And I knocked on like seven doors.
Yeah.
And Tom was you know, kind enough to give me a chance.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And we could spend the entire 45 minutes going through your professional chef career.
I don't think anyone cares.
But,
let's not do that.
We're going to sort of fast forward to the day in 2014 where you decide to, the way I picture it is like, you always had this vat of broth on the stove at hearth. And in my brain, this could not be the story. So please correct me if I'm wrong. You were like, this should be served in cups and people should just be drinking this that aren't, you know.
You know what? It is kind of that simple.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, broth is the staple of a chef's kitchen forever. I've always had hearth broth hanging around, whether it's holidays growing up as a kid or my first restaurant job and Gramercy Tavern, we had two stock kettles. Mm-hmm. And like making broth on the regular is the way you build your dishes.
Flavors, yeah.
Yeah, your flavors.
And also, just for people listening who might not know, it's also a really nice, sustainable way to use an entire animal or to use parts of the animal that you wouldn't necessarily eat. And you get all of the good collagen from all of the joints
that.
So it's like super healthy too.
One of the cool things at Gramercy is everything was cooked. We cooked all the meat on the bone.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a bandsaw and we'd do like little venison chops and lamb chops and beef chops. And everything was on the bone and we roasted everything on the bone and cut it off the bone.
Right.
And at the end of the night, we had like tons of like roasted bone.
Yeah.
And they would always get put into the stock kettles and they added so much flavor.
Yeah, we actually do that at Havens, too.
So yeah, then, I'm sure. Why throw it away?
Exactly. So then was there, like, how did you come up with, like, the little window and the coffee cup thing?
Yeah, so the window, the window had always been there, mm-hmm. and I had always looked at that damn window and said, God, it's like right. It started as my pastry kitchen, yeah. and the window was right on First Avenue.
Yeah.
Our entrance is on the street. And I always thought we could sell something out there. And there were so many iterations of what I wanted to sell. It was like apple cider donuts were a big thing when we opened in 2003. Yeah. And I was like, we could just do a donut window. Like yeah. on Martha's Vineyard, there's this famous place that sells donuts, mm-hmm. backdoor donuts. And I was like, we could do donuts. And then we could do meatball sandwiches.
Yeah.
And we
pasta,
could
do pasta windows were a big thing in early New York.
Yeah.
Where they had just like a vat of pasta and sauce, right. and they just handed people things out the window.
Right.
Yeah. So
there was all kinds of things I wanted to sell out that window, and not until I fell upon the Brodo idea was I motivated to really make it happen.
Right.
And that motivation came from a few different places. One was, you know, after grinding very hard in New York City as a chef for like 15 years and hitting my early 40s, mm-hmm. I was pretty sick. I was like fat and bloated and kind of, you know, not managing people well. And mm-hmm. I was a bit of a mess, mm-hmm. Physically, emotionally. And one of the many myriad of things that I did was I replaced my 10 quarts of coffee that I was drinking every day.
Yikes.
and I had one quart of coffee, and then I would transition to drinking broth.
Yeah.
And I did that on the regular. And I believe, looking back, that what happened was is I healed my gut by drinking, having daily broth. Mm-hmm. And once my gut was healed, my body was kind of empowered to start fixing yep. all the shit that was wrong with
totally.
It.
Totally.
And I really believe that. And like I sometimes
think there's like, a lot of clinical evidence to
I think so too. But yeah. it's like, look, I'm very careful because I don't want to sound like a snake oil salesman.
Right.
But like when I tell you I truly believe that broth is the first trigger, is the first lever that fixes your gut. And then once your gut is fixed, your immune system can do the magic that yep. it's empowered to do.
Totally.
And it's like heals everything from like joint pain to acne to whatever the hell bothers you.
Right.
Fix your gut and it'll fix itself.
Yep. On that note, Andrew, something tells me you had a very different trajectory.
Indeed.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Montreal.
Okay. Oh, I think I knew that. There's a famous, in Montreal, a famous pasta window. It's the gnocchi window. Mm-hmm. In that one district.
Probably in old Montreal.
Yeah. It's like, there's just it's like a tiny little window and they have like vats of gnocchi and it's just that covered in
awesome.
Sauce and it's amazing.
Road trip.
So yeah. Food in Montreal, though. So were you a food kid or not really? Or it was just because the food there is so good?
The food is amazing. Certainly enjoyed the food. But, you know, my home food experience, my mom, you know, would definitely go to, you know, farmers markets. She took great pride mm-hmm. in her cooking. But it was more of a traditional, it was more about being around the table.
Right.
It was more about, you know, very traditional roles. But yes, I mean, I loved, you know, but very traditional Quebecois food was
right.
a big part of how I grew up. Sloppy
were
Joe's,
both of
poutine.
Your parents from Montreal or were they from other places?
My dad grew up in Toronto or was
right.
born in Toronto, but they met at college in Montreal at McGill.
Okay.
And so yeah, I, you know, it's been fun. I've always appreciated good food, but you know, certainly we'll talk about Brodo, but
right.
On a personal level, Marco, you know, has been great at pushing me. And we're, one of the things I'm sure talk about is we're complementary in
yes.
very many ways. You know, in fact, our entire company, I would say there's almost zero overlap in skills and capabilities.
I'm so excited to talk about that.
And,
that's a big question.
And
so,
you know, my mom again was a great cook and took so much pride in it, but it's about coming together. He will say, take a picture of what you're cooking, you
right.
know, send me a picture of what you're cooking on the weekend, you know? And so he's always trying to push me
right.
to do more.
Yes,
and,
chef.
And you know, that's a big part of who we are as a company. So I'm a good test
right.
subject at times.
And you went, I mean, you studied business in college.
Yes.
Did you know you wanted to be in the business world in some way? Did you,
yes.
do you remember what you wanted to be when you grew up, when you were little?
Well, you grew up in Montreal. So of course you want to be a professional
hockey player. Yeah.
you know, I guess in college, so I went to business school.
Right.
I was surrounded, you know, my brother was very entrepreneurial as a kid, so I was around him a lot, and he was, you know, my big brother, and he was a big example. So I was always working, you know. I had a paper route at a time when you had to, you delivered the papers, and then you went and collected the money.
You know, one of my guests, I don't remember who it is, Maddie or Matt, you might remember, someone said, I wasn't exactly entrepreneurial, but I was enterprising. I think is a really interesting way to put it. Like, you weren't necessarily like, I'm going to sell you three stickers for the price of two, but you were always interested in working.
Correct.
Yeah. That's interesting.
So
that's
whether
cool.
that was paper routes, you know, working in a bank, pool cleaning company with my best friend. So I was always working.
And how did you, because I know you kind of landed into the Coca-Cola ecosystem. How did you land there, and what were you... Were you in like the world of CPG, and how did you, what kind of niche did you find there? And then I want to get to how you met.
Great. Yeah, I was very lucky. At the time, it was mid 90s, Coca-Cola pricing was the lowest in the entire world. And so it was a real challenge. Private label was huge in Canada, mostly led by Loblaws and President's Choice. And Coca-Cola system, I worked on the bottling side, brought up kind of a dream team up there to fix it. And and one of the things they did was they put together a management training program. And I was the first person hired into that management training program.
Cool.
So it was very, very terrific cross-functional training. And then I ended up moving into sales, and I kind of did every different job.
So cross-functional in the sense that, you know, when I talk, I always sort of break it down into like operations and then sales and then distribution and then marketing. And you kind of touched on the whole ecosystem of a CPG product. Is that
with the exception of the less so on the manufacturing side, but started in finance, managed sales, and then did a lot of, you know, sales operations work. So managed a fleet of truck drivers and sold to restaurant service accounts.
Very cool.
And then I actually left, this is also entrepreneurial side, but again, leaving with some momentum, and joined a small, really one other guy doing consulting to Coca-Cola bottlers in Japan. And really interesting time.
Right.
I think at the time the Coca-Cola Japan was 3% of the Coca-Cola system's revenue and 20% of their profit, because it was all being sold through vending machines.
Right.
So it was a lot of focus on that, and certainly probably a precursor to our view of kind of having a direct relationship with the consumer and what
you
does that
you guys
mean?
Could have Brodo vending machines.
Don't get me started.
Oh my gosh, that's so cool. Okay, so... All right. Again, Marco, we just actually before the show, you were saying, because I thought it was pretty quickly that you met Andrew, but it wasn't actually that quickly. But question is, like, in my case, I love brick and mortar. I love the cooking school. I did not want to grow that. I looked at it and I just sort of thought, like, I'm not competing in the world of fast casual. I'm not competing in the world of cooking content. So what part of this is growable? And it seemed to me that, you know, that combined with sort of the mission of getting people cooking and what the students were saying, a product and this particular product made perfect sense. Mm-hmm. I knew going into it that I wasn't going to do it unless it was actually scalable and it was going to be different than the brick and mortar business. I'm gathering you had the same... You wanted to create a product that wasn't just another same old.
Absolutely.
Right. And so going into it, you knew that you had to set it up in a way that was smart and strategic. And
well, look, I did not conceive of it with like this big growth plan in mind, right? I really conceived of it as this is going to be a cool thing to do. I'm going to have some fun doing it. I'm making broth anyway.
Right, but you weren't making that much broth.
No,
right,
I'm making a 230-gallon pots in the basement that I still make today.
Yeah.
And not until I launched it and did it really catch on fire did I realize, like,
you have
holy
to build
hell,
the whole
like,
thing.
There's an opportunity here that I'm very excited to try to, you know, capitalize on. But like you, look, Hearth is 16 years old, and I have done very little outside of... I do not want another Hearth.
Right.
It is just too operationally challenging. It's not a great business at all.
No.
it's the last thing I want to scale. I look at the John Georges of the world and I'm like, how on God's green earth does this man operate 100 awesome restaurants around the globe? Like, it blows my mind.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things that I've really loved about the notion of broth is like the simplicity of it. And, you know, I've learned a lot in the last 4 years, but back in the day when I launched it, I was like, this is perfect for growth because, you know, what I thought was like high yield, which I learned it's not. But at the time I was like, wow, you could make a big pot and you get a ton of this stuff.
Right.
And then I season it once and then I freeze it and it's just like perfect. Yeah. I don't need any, I don't need humans. It's just like, it's this thing that I could make right once and then have like 500 of them. And I thought like that is such the path to scalability and growth. And like you, I didn't know shit about commercialization, grocery. I mean, I really had to start, I had this like vision and this idea and notion of like how easy it would be. And like, holy cow, it turns out it's probably harder than the restaurant business.
I mean, I think what's funny is people will say sort of like, do you know how hard CPG is? And I'll be like, yeah, I mean, yeah, but I'm also in the other hardest industry in the world, and, and we're still okay, and you figure it out, you know, and you learn, and you ask questions, and you meet people. I think, like both things, you know, I heard something really good. It, you can talk about all everything, but at the end of the day, it comes down to product, team, and market. And if you have a great product and a great team, but there is no market for your product, good luck. So you happen to hit at a very good time because I think you partially helped to create that market for sure. But between sort of like people looking into all of the functionality that there is, also kind of sort of a resurgence in, you know, whole animal eating or even just, even if it's the vegan one, just all of the, you know, the benefits that you can get from eating this way, especially like, you know, the keto thing and the whole thing. You hit the market at the right time, but you knew, and this is where I kind of want to get to, you knew you wanted to grow it. Did you know, did you say to yourself, if it hits this, then I'm really ready to go out and hire a CEO? Or were you just kind of like, I'm going to hire a CEO? Cause what I love about this is I don't think I've had someone on yet who, cause at some point I might find out I'm not a CEO. I might be a really good founder. I hope, but but you knew going in that you wanted a CEO, which I think is a very self-knowledge thing. Self-aware is the word I'm looking for.
Thanks, Andrew. And you know, Tom Colicchio was the master at realizing where his weaknesses were and hiring for his weaknesses. So I, you know, I Katie Greco. You know, he's the master at that. So, and he was, you know, I worked under him for almost 10 years. So, I learned a lot from watching him do his thing. And like, look, I'm a creative, I'm an artistic guy and I'm a cook and that's my world. So when we launched the window and it went off the rails and people were buying these frozen glass jars like crazy. And people were like running up to the window with like an insane amount of enthusiasm. And then I watched the space kind of erupt. I watched a lot of brands that had their toe in the water of selling what a premium broth kind of explode. I really felt a lot of pressure to move quickly. And I've heard you interview people and you know, I really pay a lot of attention and read and listen a lot. And everyone speaks to how quickly things happen today. In a way, it didn't happen so quickly a decade ago. And boy, did I watch that happen, because like in 3 years' time, there's like 70, there's 70 brands of premium broth out there.
Well, so, I think there are a couple, I mean, we've talked about this too, but there are a couple of reasons for that. One, it's a lot easier to raise money on just an idea now than it ever was. You don't even have to have a product and you can raise money as long as you're willing to give away a bunch of equity. You know, the other is packaging. Everyone can design everything, you know? And the, I think the biggest one is probably the internet. You know, because you can make something in your bathroom. And if you put up a cool Instagram page, you can do, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in sales.
Yeah, like, no doubt.
You know, just by buying some ads.
And grocery is more open to taking on smaller brands,
for
right?
For sure.
Your last guest was just speaking about that.
They're not as picky anymore. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Well, I have thoughts about that. Mm. I think it's actually kind of hard to get through a buyer, especially in a crowded category, because there really are only so many slots on a shelf. So they're not as willing to take a risk as I think maybe James thought they were. But he knows.
So anyway, there was a lot of you know, I felt a lot of pressure to move quickly.
Yep.
And, you know, I made some mistakes early on, like our first CEO hire. It was like I fell under the gun, and I kind of pushed that decision too quickly, and I hired somebody from corporate world, and it was like the worst idea ever, and it was such
a bad fit.
It was not a
personal,
good fit.
Yeah,
it's like he came from massive corporate world to startup New York City restaurant guy who opened up this window. Like he was like, holy shit, what's going on?
Yeah,
and it's why, you know, I'm so grateful to have Andrew on board now, because, you know, he was a local guy. He had a really great work ethic.
Yeah.
While he did come from somewhat of a corporate environment, it was just very different.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a big Campbell Soup type corporate thing. And, you know, as you know, it's like when you're a young startup, especially omnichannel like we are, it's like our core group of people, headed up by Andrew, it's like, we do a million things.
Yeah. I want to get to how it looks now. I'm going to take a little break, and then we're going to come back and talk about how you guys have structured the team and how you manage conflict and all sorts of fun things. We'll be right back. In the Sauce is brought to you by Oatly, the vegan plant-based oat milk originally from Sweden that's now making their oat milk on this side of the Atlantic. About 30 years ago, in a small town in Sweden, a scientist invented oat milk, and everyone thought he was totally crazy. Fast forward to New York 30 years later, and we just can't keep it in stock at Haven's Kitchen. That's because it tastes great and foams really well in coffee, but I think also a lot of the customers at Haven's Kitchen drink it because it has much less environmental impact than regular cow's milk and uses a ton less water to produce than almond milk. So while it's an amazing product, I think more and more people in the US and around the world are starting to understand the benefits of eating and drinking oat milk. You can find out more about Oatly, the vegan plant-based oat milk originally from Sweden, at oatly.com. That's OATLY.com.
You listen to Heritage Radio Network because, let's face it, you have really good taste. You care about where your food comes from, who made it, and its impact on the planet. Whether you're looking for an inspiring interview with your favorite celebrity chef, the latest on Dave Arnold's Spinzall, or if you want to get down and dirty with some agricultural policy, we've got you covered. 10 years in and 13,000 episodes later, HRN continues to be the go-to media outlet for thoughtful eaters like you. And we never could have done it without the support of our listeners. Help Food Radio continue in the future and help us raise enough funds for the year to come. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today. And since you've got such good taste, we have some very cool member gifts for you to choose from. Thanks for listening and for being a part of the HRN community.
I'm back with Marco and Andrew from Brodo. So let's talk a little bit about what the business looks like now. So from production, obviously you're not making 100 stores and like a subscription base
in my basement
in your basement anymore. And Andrew, were you there for like the sort of migration from the basement to a more industrialized system?
Not phase one.
Not phase one. And then is phase one what it looks like now or no? Okay. So what does it look like now? Where are you producing? How do you deal with that? Yeah.
So as Marco mentioned, he still produces in the basement of Hearth. we are significantly exceeding that capacity.
Yes.
So some of the work that Marco had done before I joined was finding a co-manufacturer.
Right.
And I will throw it back to him because his standard of how he wanted to make broth did not exist in the world.
No.
So they went through a very long process, and he can talk to you about some of his requirements, which I respect all the time. But one of the challenges was that location could make the broth in bulk, but it could not put it into packages that were CPG ready.
Right.
So when I joined...
So you had another leg of the journey, so they would make it, and then you'd have to... oh, yeah.
Correct. So we were making it in bulk.
Just listeners, founders, any leg of the journey that you add is going to add cost, and that is bad. So try to have as few legs as possible. Back to you, Andrew.
Indeed. So the good news is, you know, we had a product that was, you know, made one place, shipped somewhere else, packaged, shipped back again, and we were doing fairly large runs.
And
so
frozen
they were,
all the way.
Correct. In fact, so imagine frozen.
No,
unfreeze,
I mean,
freeze.
Yeah.
And so the good or bad news is we couldn't go
super
very far.
Super easy, Marco.
I know.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We couldn't go very far with that package,
right?
And it was very, very expensive. So since then, we have chipped away at that. We now can, you know, produce and fill in the same location.
Amazing.
We've got another location. So we have three co-manufacturers now that we
have
that
trained.
We use, yeah. And they've trained on the Marco way. So that's it's. But you know, as you know, in that co-packer world, it takes a while to undo and redo and manage through the inventory. And so this December, we're actually rolling out a new CPG package, which is going to be smaller, rebranded, and we're extremely excited about it.
Okay, cool. Because I know the two. I know the one that's like the bigger frozen one that I keep in my freezer and I defrost, or I just like... I like how it slides out of the quart into the pot. Like, I'm always worried it's not going to, and then it just like slides right out. I love that. And then the sippy cups. Or I call them sippy cups, but they're the ones with like the
single
sticker.
Serve.
Yeah, the single serves. Yeah. I love those too. Yeah. So are those are both not going to be?
Those. So the single serve will survive in certain channels, and then the 30 ounces migrating to the 22 ounce.
Got it. Okay. And then in terms of sort of, Marco, you use the word, and I just want to be very like non-jargony as I can, omnichannel. I think people who are listening to this consistently at this point have heard me say it enough, but how do you kind of, I always talk about a pie chart. So you have the stores.
Yes.
Are they...
Or shops.
Or shops. Would you guys consider those real revenue makers, or are they more like a marketing line item, et cetera, for the...
They're absolutely
revenue
and profit.
Right.
Not all of them are humming exactly the way we'd like yet, but we are absolutely committed to them as a way to expand the category.
So that's going to be, in your pie chart, a nice wedge.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so is it kind of like scoop shops for a Jenny's type of thing where you just plan on having them all over the place?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the books I brought to my interview was Pour Your Heart Into It. So the Starbucks story.
Oh.
And we've definitely talked about this notion of you know, early precursors of coffee, and everyone thought they were crazy to be coming with $4 coffees. And here we are with something that is admittedly a premium product, but... We like the idea of being in neighborhoods.
Totally.
And neighborhoods is what drives, you know, health, and neighborhood is what drives cooking, if we can help people do that. And you obviously
and
are
you
a
don't need
example.
A big footprint, which is so great. Right. I mean, I can't open a you know, what's the square footage on those? Like tiny.
Well, we have our smallest one is in Astor Place right now, which is about 150 feet.
But I mean,
the largest one is about 700 square feet, including the basement.
Yeah. Right. I mean, that's great. You know?
Yeah, for Manhattan especially.
Yeah, I mean, really for anywhere, because you can kind of like pop up anywhere like we were talking about. And then going back to the channels, I know you have a subscription on your website.
Yep.
I'm always curious about this because we can't do anything really like that. We're trying to figure out if we can or what it would look like or selling directly, but sauce is a little different. I am a good target for a subscription of broth. How do you see that? Are you leaning into that, or do you think that
you know, people will be buying it off of your website more or less, or how do
we are leaning into it. You want me to take that?
Yeah, go ahead.
We are leaning into it right now, but it's been mostly because we were getting so many requests.
Right.
So we started fulfilling them out of the basement of right. our Hudson shop, which yeah. was hilarious. And and we have some great photos of that because you have to see the basement of our Hudson shop.
That's my shop.
So that was, you know, step one. And then we were getting requests from people on the West Coast, mm-hmm. and they were shipping it, you know, air over.
And how do you handle the shipping? I mean, they pay for shipping for like FedEx frozen overnight or like how
two
do
day.
You 2 day?
So we really originally we were shipping it over there by air because and people were absolutely paying for it.
Yeah,
but it's obviously not something we knew was sustainable. So
right.
we now we use ground. And then we have a really great package that is a biodegradable insulation that
right.
you can basically, you know, wash down your sink. And so we are believers in it. I think that it will morph over time, but certainly outside of New York, it's a great opportunity
yeah.
for us to spread the brand.
Right, for sure. I mean, that's the number one reason to do it, because, like, I think I've said this 1,000 times on the show, too. Like, we haven't really even been able to do national press because you mm-hmm. can't. There's no call to action. So
right.
you go to our website and then thump nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense that you would, you know, it's a good idea. And then what percentage of that pie chart would you say is the plan for grocery distributed shelves? Like, is that the big kahuna?
So it's absolutely part of the growth plan, but I think we've got a bunch to prove still.
Right.
And so, you know, if we're honest, it's definitely part of the plan. We have, you know, very clear objectives in by channel. But, you know, that it hasn't been we self-distributed to the Williamsburg Whole Foods for about a year.
Mm-hmm.
We did really well there. And then we've, you know, worked our way from there. John Lawson's been a great partner and
yeah.
he's extended us out gradually. But, you know, he's been a good partner to say, look, don't go too fast.
Yep.
So we now are in, we were in all of Manhattan and then we were in
yep,
all of the Northeast.
Right.
And, you know, he's now trying to connect a few dots for us into other regions. So we've been, you know, slow, you know, running that one pretty slow. And a lot of it also was because of the package.
Right.
We knew
right.
there was like the people who really wanted it would buy it. But you know, we had some performance issues with the package.
Yep.
There was a lot going on.
No, and so. That's his whole thing, which is so smart, is like make all of your mistakes when they're
slow.
Not
yeah.
everywhere, you know, when you can still fix them, you know, which you guys are doing exactly. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, when we go back to sort of like that team, product, market, mm-hmm. right? Team, we're going to talk about the two of you especially. Product, we've covered, I think. Market. Do people think, and I mean, Marco, you and I have talked about this. I think people think of broth as functional.
Mm-hmm.
I think they think I'm getting my collagen and it's good for my microbiome. I don't think that they know how good it can taste,
mm-hmm.
Especially if they haven't had yours.
Right.
So how are you, are there other, I don't know, sorry, but are there other broths in frozen right now, or are most of them in shelf stable? And if there are other ones in frozen, how are you thinking about sort of distinguishing yourself?
Mm-hmm.
But if they're mostly in shelf stable, my guess is that there's a big price difference between the shelf stable broths and yours. And how are mm-hmm. you going to get people to migrate over to frozen? Big question.
Yeah, that is a big question. And it's been, you know, it's been on our mind for sure, right? Like the vast majority of broth has been shelf stable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been shelf stable for many, many, many decades.
Yeah.
So the whole functional thing, you know, really just came
goes away.
Just it's a late, you know, it's lately yeah. that we've been talking about the functionality of it. You know, the funny thing is like most of those shelf stable broths are really just very watery. They don't have much protein.
Salt.
They don't show any gelatin.
Yeah.
And they're not made well. So there's no functionality with like 90% of the shelf stable broths that are on the market.
Yeah.
You know, getting people to understand to go to frozen for broth
yeah.
is a huge challenge for us.
Right.
I don't think, you know, your local grocery guy is not going to be okay with putting a big sign in the shelf stable area that says,
no.
Go find the broth and frozen.
It's so funny. I wish. We said the same thing. We're like, maybe we could just put a sign like, there's also fresh sauce over there.
Exactly.
By the, you know,
I
right.
mean, how else yeah. will they know, right?
But so, you guys have such a great side-by-side. I mean, I'm just picturing my, when I pour out the, you know, and the you can see the collagen 100%. Sticking to right the thing versus like pouring out one of those yucky in the Tetra Pak.
For like 3 years now, I've been saying, like, I want to do the Pepsi challenge
yeah.
of broth, you know? Yeah. And like, here are the competitors and taste them because
totally.
I believe once people try it,
yeah.
they will come back,
yeah.
which is, you know, I've learned this from you, which is like a really important piece of growing a CPG brand yeah. because, you know, you gotta get them to, and then it's like, do they come back? And if they do, then you're onto something,
yes.
right?
That's the ticket.
And, you know, one of the concerns that we have is there's a lot of broth out there that doesn't taste great.
Yeah.
So if I'm a new consumer introduced to bone broth and the functional benefits of bone broth, and I'm like, wow, I'm going to try this bone broth thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you go and buy some, like, mm-hmm. shelf-stable, weird premium broth,
mm-hmm.
and you taste it, and it's like, it turns people off from the category.
Yeah.
So we're really working hard at trying to
educate consumers.
Educate yep. consumers, which, as you know, is very difficult
yeah.
and very expensive.
Yes.
But like, I've never been afraid of a challenge.
Yeah.
I've been working in the restaurant business in New York City for
you
20
can't
years.
Deter
so
you.
Like, no, like I'm fine.
Yeah.
I think slow and steady wins the race.
Totally.
I think that we have an incredibly delicious broth
yep.
that shows gelatin. And if people start cooking with it, they're going to be like, oh my God, that's the best soup I ever made.
Yep.
Or that's the best pan sauce I ever made. And yep. I got to believe that that will drive,
yeah.
You know, people coming back to our brand.
I think the other thing, and I'm going to pat us on the backs mm. for a moment. Like, I think that being, you know, I kind of always talk about sort of the finance founders and then the food founders.
Mm-hmm.
And like, we might not know how to make a spreadsheet and we might not like be very equipped at like a P&L or mm-hmm. whatever, but we, I think, are a little bit more, we'll try things that don't necessarily have a very clear return on investment.
Yeah.
So I think we intuitively know that we both are going to spend a lot of money on demoing. Like we just
yeah.
are, and we should, and that's mm-hmm. okay. And someone from like a more traditional finance background might be like, well, how do you, you're not going to be able to, that's my financial background voice.
Yes.
That's, I have my voices
nicely
of like,
done.
I have like the douchey guy voice and then I have the financial background voice, but that's, you know, that's how we're going to do it. We're going to get a lot of people to taste it because they taste yours and the minute that they taste it, they're hooked.
That's the hope.
And then you got to get them past the price point. But if you're changing your sizes a little bit, it seems like maybe there's a little bit of room in the price
yep.
point that's going to happen also.
But it's also, if it's a catalyst for making something, then all the numbers change, right? So if I can take a broth
right.
and I can make it into a fantastic meal or soup or what have you,
yep.
suddenly, you know, that money I'm spending
yep.
has got a lot more leverage.
Totally.
And by the way, you know, if you drink broth instead of a big meal
yep.
and you substitute for a little less,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, I think even in the fast casual world, I find even the healthy companies, there's just so much that you get.
Yeah.
And so if it's checking that box, it says, wow, I just had a meal and I feel great,
mm-hmm.
then everyone's a winner.
Yeah.
You know? So
getting back to team, let's talk about when a founder is not a CEO. when have you guys ever had an argument?
I mean, maybe little ones, nothing major.
Okay.
I would agree, yeah.
All right.
I mean,
have you,
we disagree on things for sure, but I think we're pretty, I wouldn't say we're conflict averse, but I think we're pretty good at working through conflicts.
Right. So do you come with like the standards and the vision and you're kind of like the, you know, the Pied Piper of the whole thing and you, Andrew, are the make it happen and be the grown up in the room kind of thing? Like do you have job descriptions written down?
I don't have a job description. I will say that I was very, very clear from moment one that, you know, part of what excites me about this is the notion of learning.
Mm-hmm.
Because I basically had my head in an oven
yeah.
running kitchens for two decades, and I was over it, and I wanted to do something else. And when we landed on this broth thing and we realized we wanted to grow it, I made it very clear to everybody who was ever hired, like, look, I may not be an expert, but I want to learn, so you better include me in the conversation and in the decision process, if for nothing else, because I want to learn, and I want to get better, and I want to understand. And by the way, I have a point of view.
And it's hard to be the visionary for something if you're totally not connected to the reality of how, like, it gets made.
This is so much my baby, and I care so much about our mission and the product. And it's like, it would be foolish for me not to be involved.
Right.
But I got to tell you, when, you know, there's weekly calls about, you know, the subscription services that are happening, and these guys are like going at it about the nitty gritty. Like, I'm so happy to be like, I feel really lucky. And I'm very grateful to have, Andrew, because it's like, I really am, you know, I'm so fortunate to have Andrew to deal with some of the shit that I don't want to deal with. And I realize that I'm lucky, because I get to kind of be like, I can't deal with this conversation right now. He can't do that, unfortunately.
Right.
I'm sure he wants to do that sometimes.
Right.
So it works.
And the org chart, I mean, how many people are now on the team?
Two of us, and then we have five other full-time.
And do they all...
Including, of course, we have 50 or 60 shop staff.
And they all report up to you, Andrew.
There's a couple sub-reporting relationships in there.
Okay.
So I have four direct reports.
Got it. And then what is the cadence of the... Do you meet every week? Do you guys have a phone call at the end of every day? How have you organized the time and sort of systemized the relationship?
Mm-hmm. It's a, well, we do have a weekly shop meeting that's more focused on the shop, so we tend to digress into all sorts of things at times. So I wouldn't pretend that we have a super tight, you know, process, but I think we communicate a lot, and we run ourselves like a small company. Fridays, if we meet at Hearth, which is very nice place to meet. If you stick around, maybe you can get family meal or something. And so our staff, I think, enjoys that. And I think Marco, he does have some very clear roles, whether implicitly or explicitly. One, he's obviously around, you know, leads on the manufacturing side. Mm-hmm. He's very involved in the sourcing. So when we go on sourcing, you know, trips, he's front and center.
Right.
He's building those relationships. He's very involved in products. So our product has actually morphed quite a bit, both in the shops and in the grocery world. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, occasionally he'll go back to, you know, old Marco Chef Marco.
Right.
Yelling, and, you know, how many years have we been making pasta together?
Is there a COO or?
Not yet.
No. Not yet. So... It's you, and then there's sort of like a big sort of step to the next tier of leadership.
Yeah. So, I don't know if it's a big step. We're all pretty tightly connected, but we have someone who basically does all the shop operations, and then we have someone who helps, gives them leverage for managing our supervisors.
Right.
Then we have a head of logistics, so dealing from the co-manufacturer into the warehouse.
Okay, so that's good that you don't have to deal with
that.
Yeah.
And then we have you know, a combination of marketing and customer service support as well.
And what about sales?
We just hired a great new salesperson, so we're pretty excited about that.
Awesome. And is the goal for 2020... just kind of keep doing the independents and the small natural grocers? Do you want to expand sort of geographically? How are you thinking about it?
I think it's not going to be, we're certainly interested in expanding, and we think we've got a great package to do that.
Right.
But again, we're, you know, to some degree, we're following the leads of our buyers, and I think we got great relationships with them. Fresh Direct was a huge early supporter of ours. And, you know, we got it pulled into Food Kick, and then pretty quickly we were on Fresh Direct, and so they've been terrific with us.
They're awesome.
Well.
They really are. I mean, I have very...
Their transition was a little challenging, but they've been such a great partner for us.
When did you know that you had an app? Like, when did you know this was, like, going to be a thing? Like, when was this, like, okay, this is actually a business, and now I'm going to be doing this business now?
I knew pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You know, I worked when I opened the window, I worked that window for 3 months. Mm-hmm. Like every day, all day long, I fulfilled every cup of broth. And it went from like the first day, you know, doing like $160 in sales.
Yeah.
And like 6 weeks later, it was like ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely ridiculous. And like, and I kind of knew then because I was, again, I was really watching health and wellness. I was reading a ton about nutrition. And it was just all, yeah. it went viral.
I'm so like glad crazy, that viral. You haven't watered it down. I remember in 2014 reading about it and being like, I hope that this doesn't become like the juice world where they've taken something so good and so real. And in order to cost cut and make it, you know, have a shelf life, mm-hmm. they end up, you know, killing everything, adding everything and watering the whole thing down. And you haven't,
we've been asked to,
I'm sure you have times. Because it's expensive, yeah. but I, you know,
but that's why I love Frozen.
Yeah.
I'm so into Frozen.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, the problem with all the juice stores is like, oh, after 24 hours, you have to throw it away.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Organic Avenue threw away 30% of everything. And yeah. like, it's not a viable business.
No.
If you're using really good ingredients, yeah. doing it right, and then throwing away 30%.
Yep.
It's
no.
just not viable.
Frozen is great. It's just, it's expensive and the margins are crappy. And there's just a lot. I mean, trucks are hard. And trucks are really hard when they have to be temperature controlled. Yep. And then they have to go far.
But it's a big growing category.
Yes, for sure. I agree. And then what do you wish for both of you? What do you wish you would have known earlier for the people listening? What's like a good chunk of advice that you wish someone had given you?
I think just reminding ourselves that nobody's really done what we've done, mm-hmm. you know? So I think, you know, we continue to look for expertise, and I think we're both very open to expertise. And I think Marco, as the business guy, looks to me a lot for mm-hmm. the answers.
You are the business guy.
Sometimes yeah. I say, you know, nobody's done this before, so we're going to have to figure it out.
Right.
And that's a big part of what I have enjoyed about it and why I took the role. But I think it's easy to forget that sometimes. Mm-hmm. And shows like yours absolutely help us avoid some of the mistakes, but we've been ignoring a lot of advice along the way, mm-hmm. and I hope it serves us well because right. I think the food system
like water
needs
it down.
To change.
Yeah.
And we
make it a powder.
We're going to do the
make
hard work
powder,
to help it.
Yeah. Jesus. Well, there is a lot of evidence that you know, especially millennial consumers, they know the difference between quality and lack of quality, and they might buy something crappy once, but they're not going to buy it again, like we said. And they are willing to pay a premium for quality. Mm-hmm. Like,
for sure.
More and more people, it's the same thing with clothing. You're going to have like your really nice watch and then your really meh stuff, but you're not going to have that middle so much anymore. And I think it's the same with food. They're going to buy bulk where they can buy bulk, and they're going to, you know, spend less where they can in like commodity food. Yeah. But when it comes to sort of like the things that are really going to like sort of shine in their diets or in their lives, they're willing to pay the money for it, you know? Any words of caution or advice?
Well, you know, one, patience and go slow, you know, slow and steady. Like, I've always been a slow and steady guy. Mm-hmm. And I kind of fell victim to,
yeah,
you know, the success of that window kind of lit a fire under me that I wish I would have blown out.
Yeah.
Because
tempered
I didn't,
a little
or
bit.
Tempered a little yeah. bit. Like, I didn't need to feel as anxious as I did. And yeah. I wish I would have just like calmed down and taken some breaths and realized like it's okay.
And but, Marco, last question for you. For the founders listening, what do you think they should be looking for in themselves where they should consider that maybe they should find themselves a CEO?
I think it's an ego thing. And now that I'm, you know, turned 50, it's like, I think you just have to acknowledge and accept the things you're not good at. And like, I'm absolutely not ashamed of it. It's not an embarrassing thing. Like, it's not a big deal to admit that you're not great at something. I don't know, like whether it's a spreadsheet or negotiating a contract,
right.
It's like, I can't read through a legal document to save my life. Like, right. I want to shoot myself in the face. Yeah. Like, I can't. It's like Chinese, right? And, like, that's fine. And it's like, I hire an accountant to do my taxes.
Yeah.
So, look, I've made a great product. I'm a chef. I care about the sourcing. I care about the animals. I care about the people. You know, there's a lot that I care about, and there's a lot that I'm good at, and I'm really proud of those things. And I'm so, you know, I'm thrilled to have Andrew on board. Like, we're a dynamic duo.
Yep.
And we complement each other really well. And I think that there's a lot of power in that, right?
Yeah, so totally.
Don't try to be a hero.
Yeah.
It's so silly.
Awesome. Andrew, do you have any last thought that you'd like to add?
I always try to let Marco do the vast majority of the talking because he is our best salesman. Convinced me to take this leap. But I will say that we spend a lot of time on strategy together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Listen, two brains are better than one is all I can say.
Can I quickly say something?
Sure.
I just want to acknowledge, like, this podcast and what you've done is, like, so generous. And I'm, like, so, thrilled at the work you've been doing because it's, like, it's really, you're basically doing it to help everybody else. And it speaks volumes about, you know, who you are.
Oh, thank you.
So, well, I'm very grateful.
Thank you. On that note, thank you. Matt, thanks for being the best engineer all season. This is the last episode of the season. We'll be back in January with more really fun guests. I did start this to help people because I realized that I get to meet a lot of people that are a lot more, you know, smart and experienced in this stuff. And I shouldn't keep those conversations to myself. So if you are liking the podcast, it would be nice if you could go onto iTunes and rate it just because it does help other people get to listening to it. Thank you for a great season, and we'll be back in January.
Thank you so much.
In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.